You said 12, because there was a ripple of yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
Only 12. Okay, listen. Yeah. Great. We'll perhaps carry on this chat later on. We now have a series of 10-minute talks, and then the younger members at the far end of the table, you've got 5 minutes each. Yeah, nice try. Okay. So, listen, if I could, Julia, if you come up first, and it's the left button to go to the next one. I misinformed you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Juliet McCann, and I'm service leader for the Additional Support for Learning Service in the City of Edinburgh. You may know us, our previous title was the Hospital and Outreach Teaching Service, so we've been amalgamated with the VTSS, which is the Visiting Teachers, the Visiting Specialist Teachers, and we're now known as the Additional Support for Learning Service, but it's essentially the same. We're a group of teachers that have a base in the Sick Children's Hospital in Edinburgh. We teach one-to-one at the bedside. We also have a schoolroom in CAMHS in Tipperlin, and we have a group of teachers who are out in the community for learners who are at home with a medical condition and too unwell to attend school. In actual fact, be the same pupils, sometimes in hospital, sometimes they're at home, and we follow them home. Just to be clear, this is from a City of Edinburgh perspective. It's not necessarily the same in all different education authorities. We are quite a big authority, so we have quite, you know, we're well resourced in terms of staffing for learners who are out of school for whatever reason, but obviously I'm just talking about the medical side this afternoon. Our main pupil population comes from the haematology, oncology, neurology, and learners that have chronic illnesses, which mean that they have sustained absences from school. In terms of our learners in CAMHS, it's the very sickest young people in the city, those that are in the inpatient unit with a sort of serious eating disorders, early onset psychosis, that sort of thing. So that they're the ones that we support. So there's a legal underpinning to any request for support from our service. And I've had a number of people say to me over the years, well, you know, what's the point? Why do you bother? You know, if they're off school, even schools have said, well, they're off school, so we'll just leave them. And sometimes there's, you know, a degree of persuasion involved with actually, you know, even with the young person's family at times, although not so much, it's more with other with schools and other adults who sort of say, oh, we'll just let them be off school. But in an awful lot of cases, learners are off school, but well enough to learn, and in an awful lot of cases, want to maintain their learning. We also have a duty as an authority to maintain this learning as far as the young person is able. And there's the various acts that will back us up with that. The tricky thing that we come across, our service comes across, is that there's no interpretation of the legislation. What it actually says is that adequate provision should be made. But what's the definition of adequate provision? Our definition as a service may be completely different from what a parent thinks is enough education for their child while they're in hospital or at home. And so it's finding the balance, and it's how the City of Edinburgh interpret it, and it can be very, very different from how other authorities interpret it. We are very lucky, we've got dedicated staff. Smaller authorities don't have that, and so they're reliant in an awful lot of cases on the goodwill of the school teaching staff, you know, in their base schools to go round after school or in a free period or something like that to deliver work or deliver some actual teaching. Oh, gone the wrong way, sorry. Gone left. Okay, so you may or may not be familiar with the Getting It Right for Every Child and the Shinari Health and Wellbeing Indicators, which we all try to work towards for all our learners, whether they're in school or not. But what can we as teachers of children who are absent from school because of health conditions, how can we try to embed as many of these indicators as we can? In terms of, well, obviously, we want all our children to be safe, and with us, obviously, they're not currently healthy, but that's being addressed. But we work very closely with those that are trying to address their health, whether it's physical or mental. In terms of achieving, we endeavour to give them support and guidance with their learning, boosting their skills, their confidence and their self-esteem. We try and have high expectations of their learning. Just because they're out of school doesn't mean to say they can't achieve as well as they would if they were in school. In terms of them being nurtured, we endeavour again to have a nurturing, stimulating environment for them. It's not always possible in the hospital setting, but in terms of our CAM schoolroom, we have displays up. We encourage them to create wall displays. We display their work, and even in the Sick Children's Hospital, where we don't have a classroom, but some of the learners are in cubicles. We'll try and display their work. Obviously, we have to adhere to infection control guidance and things like that, but we try and make the environment as stimulating as we possibly can. In terms of helping them be active, again, it's active around their learning, so we try and introduce a range of learning and teaching styles where we can, giving them opportunities to take part in a wide range of activities, textbooks, games, iPads, project work, that sort of thing, to try and give them make them feel as active as they possibly can in their learning. In terms of them being respected, it's about the learner's voice, and they want to be involved, and allowing them to be involved in decisions that affect their well-being. Allow them to discuss their learning opportunities and give them a chance to decide on their learning priorities and agree targets with them instead of just telling them what they're going to do. Valuing their education helps build their self-esteem, health and well-being, and helps them feel respected. And in terms of them being responsible, again, it's about giving them some responsibility for continuing and maintaining their education where they're well enough to do so. And the most important one is making them feel included. They're actually excluded in a way, that they're not going to school, but it's our job really to allow them to feel included, to overcome their social, emotional inequalities and still feel like they're part of something, part of the school. And it's all about giving them a sense of normality as well. I mean, most of them have been plunged into a world that's full of medicine and deep medical treatments and medical professionals, and we come along and give them, hopefully, a sense of normality, allowing them to do something that their friends and peer group are still doing. So what helps? So normality, it really helps them with their health and well-being. If they feel that they're doing something, as I say, that the friends are doing out of hospital or in school, then that helps their confidence, helps them feel good about themselves. It's important that we as teachers have some level of understanding about their medical condition and how that can affect their ability to learn. And so it's important for us that we attend, I personally attend the hematology oncology psychosocial meeting, and I attend the inpatient discussions at CAMS. And so it's a need-to-know basis, but it helps me understand what the learner's going through and how we can adapt and adjust and be flexible to give them the best and most positive learning experience as we can. Communication is very important. We always make a point of contacting their base school and identifying key people that we can liaise with. So again, it helps the learner feel it included, and helps them for when we're discussing their learning, that it helps them to know that we're in touch with school. Continuity and progression. It's really important to us that we get quality information from the schools so that our next steps and you know, to inform our planning and our next steps. It's not good enough for a school just to say to us, oh, just give them a bit of spelling, or oh, just give them a wee bit of reading. We need to know what they would have been doing in the class if they'd been at school, so that they feel part of that and they don't worry, because children and young people worry about when they go back to school, what have they missed? Are they going to be dropped a group and all that sort of thing? Again, high expectations, again, within the constraints of their medical condition, but we have learners in CAMHS and in the hospital and at home preparing for their SQA exams. I mean, if they're well enough and still want to sit, then we can facilitate all of that. So we still have high expectations of their attainment and achievement, and in a wide range of subjects. Unfortunately, we don't have that many teachers at the moment in terms of being able to cover all the different secondary subjects, but hopefully with the new hospital coming and a bid for growth, we'll get more teachers for that. And finally, working towards transition, it's very important for when the learner is going back to school that we liaise with the school about where they are, next steps. It can be in a written report, but we try to go into schools and meet the staff and talk about what our experience with the learner is, what might help when they go back, if their appearance has changed, if they need any adaptations put in, if there's any training required for the staff. They may be a very different child from the one that they knew from a few weeks or months or years before, and so that's very important that we are part of that discussion. And all of that, hopefully, helps our learners with their health and well-being. I hope it works some way towards improving it. Okay, thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have a very broad church, and I think it's always fantastic to have people from different backgrounds. I don't think I've heard somebody talk from the school teacher. That was fantastic. That's a first for me. Thank you very much. Can I just ask you for a bit of focus? Because I, on my idiot-proof list, it says at 2:55, I'm going to ask you to write on green and pink post-its to think of examples of good practice that have helped level the playing field. 5 minutes afterwards, I'm going to ask one member of the team to speak up. I thought it was perhaps a bit unfair to just give you 5 minutes to have a thought and to identify a lead. So I'm giving you advance notice now. Can you have a think about what in your area has helped you to level the playing field? And there's many different contexts, but can you start doing it now? Because you can't say you didn't tell us enough in an hour's time. Anyway, sorry for that pause. Our next speaker is Russell, who's going to talk, and obviously going to listen to what he's saying, and the next talk speaks, but also think about those post-its as well. Thank you very much.
That's a lot of information. Firstly, my name's Russell Brown. You'll probably see from the heading in the notes that I'm principal teacher of pupil care and support. Effectively, that means I'm a guidance teacher. That term changes across lots of the different local authorities, but the essence is very much the same. The context, thank you, Juliet. A lot of you will think that Juliet and I got together before this day to go through what we were going to discuss. Thank you very much, because you've given a bit of context to some of the information that I will touch on today regarding GIRFEC and naturally getting it right for every child and the Shinari indicators. And hopefully I can just expand on some of the things that we do within schools to enhance the emotional and well-being of our pupils. Lots of challenges. There's huge amounts of challenges within schools for ourselves, and I'm hoping today that I can give you an appreciation of just some of the main strategies that myself as a guidance teacher and collectively as a kind of wider management team have to address on a day-to-day basis. The National Improvement Framework clearly identifies a clear focus on improvement, the improvement of attainment, the closing of the gap, not just within literacy and numeracy, but particularly as well of health and emotional well-being. We must ensure that we get it right for every child, and that every child has the right level of support at different times within their life. And throughout our curriculum that we deliver, we hope to develop skills for learning, life and work that allow them to make conscious decisions as they move through life. Apologies, when I sent this presentation, I realised that I hadn't moved the slides effectively and I haven't changed them. But today I'm hoping to, first and foremost, give you a kind of whole school approach to how we address health and emotional well-being. The school is a caring community. It's essential that the school has a shared vision and shared ethos and values to support all of our pupils and to allow them to feel comfortable and recognise that we are all pulling in the same direction for them. We want the very, very best for our children, regardless whether they're in mainstream education or, as Juliet says, at times when we have to look at alternatives for them. And finally, the approaches and challenges that we have in supporting those young people who are experiencing difficulties, maybe on a wider, longer term. I came across this this quote from Kate Middleton, and I think it clearly identifies that we need to make sure that there's now parity between physical and mental health. And that's one of the kind of key challenges that we have within schools at the moment. There's always a pull for literacy and numeracy, but it's essential that when a child has an emotional need or an emotional requirement, that we, where possible, you know, are creative enough to offer strategies and interventions to allow them to go on to fulfil their academic abilities and their academic achievement and aspirations. Okay, first of all, health and wellbeing plays a huge part within the curriculum. It's one of three of the the main core areas within the curriculum. It's one of the kind of key three areas within our curriculum. And as you can see there, it has a specific focus on health and wellbeing. But not only does it cover health and wellbeing, we also look at other areas focusing on careers intervention, but just to give one example. Effectively, what we're trying to do is we're trying to address these health and wellbeing and of trying to fall in with the government's push for early intervention and prevention, trying to really give them knowledge early in their adolescence that allow them to make good conscious decisions, allow them to have the facts to make these decisions, and allow them to kind of move through into adulthood effectively. So, in meeting these needs, there are a number of challenges that we do come across. The main ones being that it's important that we have an ethos that underpins all of our approaches. We need to help young people become self-confident. We need to allow them to, with self-esteem, self-worth, and ultimately resilience, that allow them to, to develop the skills that underpin their overall personal achievements, academic support, and emotional well-being. As I touched on beforehand, the caring community is essential. I spoke yesterday with regards to the importance of pupils knowing that we all have a shared vision, not just as an academic fraternity, but also involving parents, young people, and external agencies. But why bother? In a time where austerity cuts are really having an adverse effect on all of us as individuals and agencies, it's essential, in my opinion and in my experience, that we are able to get past and really take with us members of staff who recognise that their main focus is to get kids through and pupils, young people, through their academic levels, to get them through their English and their maths. But the whole school vision, if we do have a whole school vision, it will help us develop the kind of the confidence, the self-esteem, and equip young people with the skills that are essential in working towards the type of academic successes that they are capable of. And taking staff with us and pupils seeing the learning environment, they can ascertain and they can recognise very quickly that we are here to help. We want the very, very best for them. We want to make sure that we get it right for every child that is within our care. So, how do we identify young people with emotional vulnerabilities? Well, in a number of ways. As a guidance teacher, one of my kind of key roles is to monitor attendance concerns, observe pupils who are maybe starting to isolate themselves or starting to withdraw from mainstream schooling, a drop in academic achievement and academic performance, which again we do through bi-monthly monitoring tracking sheets that members of staff will fill in that we can basically ascertain and see if there's any anomalies or patterns that are starting to form. The wellbeing concern referrals covering scenario indicators that Juliet had touched on, what we've tried to do within the school, my current school particularly, is really to try and develop the understanding, not just within the pupils, but of the members of staff, regarding scenario indicators. We have lost a lot of universal support. We now no longer have the registration time, the universal support through registration teachers, forum teachers, tutor time, which was in a lot of ways what we would refer to as first-line guidance. It was the same person day in, day out, the continuity that member of staff had, people had with a member of staff who could recognise sometimes when problems were occurring. You know, myself as a guidance teacher of different schools, ranging from 470 through 780 at the moment, up to 1,400 children, it's really, really difficult on a day-to-day basis to see these kids and to ensure that you are part of their life, that you are recognising any triggers or any difficulties that they have. So much so that part of the kind of key things that we've looked to do is through staff referrals. We really ask staff, whether it be academic, behavioural, to refer, to share information with ourselves so that we can make a difference in their lives. Peer referrals as well, and self-referrals. Now, that can only but be achieved through the children being confident. And relating back to the academic achievement, if the children are relevant and to support members of staff and really moving with us within ethos, where we are trying to promote emotional and health and wellbeing, it develops their confidence, their self-worth, their self-esteem, their resilience. It allows them, to be that confident individual, that confident learner. And that confident individual strikes out through self-referrals. If you have a culture and an ethos and an environment where children know that you are all pulling in the same direction, we do get more self-referrals. We have children coming to us alongside their peers to share that information with us about concerns over the youngster. So, how do we support these pupils? Well, again, what we try to do, not just through universal support, we also try targeted intervention as well. Where possible, it works best, in my opinion, if we can have one-to-one support with pupils. Smaller targeted groups, that's very much what the pupils ask for. They identify that they want to have the confidence to speak about their issues, to address their learning, and sometimes to focus on their emotional and mental well-being through smaller groups, particularly with myself as a guidance teacher. Within the school, in the removal of universal support, we've also brought in this year a well-being referral forum, which has taken a bit of training. We've had to train staff, we've had to train pupils about understanding the scenario, about them rating themselves and how they feel at any point in their life, that we can then intervene, have these positive conversations with. But the members of staff in that as well are also there to share their concerns, to get that information to me sooner rather than later so that we can make those definite changes in their lives. Collaborative working, interagency work, we can't do this in isolation. We can be creative, but we cannot do this in isolation. We need partner agencies. And as a guidance teacher, one of the kind of key things that we look at is kind of our tier one system. What interventions and prevention can we put in early to try and stop the problems before they occur? That is very much part and parcel of some of our kind of key issues. The bottom part there about stage for intervention meetings basically is where we pull external agencies together. We share information on a routine basis, looking particularly at how we can get it right for those children. What interventions can we put in place, including things like listening services that were put to us from our local health practice, who are overwhelmed by the number of referrals to their practice. Pupil support workers, school support workers, I've been fortunate enough to work in some schools where we have these in abundance, which allow us to put on nurture groups, allow us to put on smaller targeted groups to really support the individuals with a variety of different needs. But then we have the other group. We have the groups. So what about the pupils or the young people who have kind of sustained issues that they need to focus on, mental and emotional well-being? Again, this slide just touches on a few of them, and it's just a finite list. But anxiety is one of the kind of key ones that we picked up from Juliet. Starting with anxiety, and very quickly just giving you an example of some of the things that we would do. We would look at bespoke timetables. We would ensure that we've got family engagement. We would make sure that we are pulling in the same direction. We would make sure that we have, you know, that partnership with them, because without partnership, nothing works. Whether that be family engagement, whether that be pupils, whether that be interagencies, or whether that be collectively amongst the school. Bespoke timetables in the sense of, do we have them in mainstream classes all of the time? Do we do an extraction model where they get some individual one-to-one supports in the hope that we can get them back into mainstream classes more effectively and more productively to allow them to fulfil their potential? Sometimes, though, the referrals have to go on to other agencies. We have the opportunity within schools and through kind of weekly and fortnightly pupil support team meetings and school support team meetings to raise concerns with education psychologists and really seek advice, because, you know, we aren't health specialists, we're education specialists, but we most definitely aren't health. But we're able to come up with creative ideas and creative strategies to support those young people. Outreach is another one, and with anxiety it goes a wee bit too far and they have real difficulties accessing school. We can refer to the outreach services. Juliet has touched on what that service does, whether that be education at home, whether that be part of education at home, and bringing them back into school. But finally, the key one of Dundee, and this is a Dundee City Council perspective, is that they have taken eight local primary, or recruited eight primary health workers and embedded them within each of the eight secondary schools at tier one level to raise the exposure, support pupils with anxiety, not just support them with anxiety, but support members of staff with that, with allowing sustainability. When we lose that resource, and we will lose that resource, most definitely, how can we sustain that in order to move forward? And probably the thoughts I would like to leave you with, the factors, we must ensure that we have a strategy that includes specialist partner engagement. It is fundamental. The links and contacts and personnel involved have a real impact on the young people. We need to measure this. We can't just throw stuff, interventions at pupils and think it's just going to work and not measure it. We need to make sure that it's working. And if it's not working, we need to go back to the drawing board. We have a curriculum, it's a skills-based curriculum, but we need to identify that sometimes that needs to be done in small group work on a one-to-one basis, because that's what makes the real difference. It is costly in time and staffing, but effectively in helping to address mental and emotional well-being, that is very much the crux and need for education. Thank you very much.
Russell, thank you very much. Some lovely continuity there between what we've previously heard, what we're about to hear, and I suspect, although he's running out of the room, what we'll hear from the very end, from the most important people in this room, who are the children and young people. Sorry, you can go. Okay.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to read from this, because if I try and just talk, I'll be ages. So, I've worked as a healthcare play specialist at the Sick Kids in Edinburgh for 10 years. I currently work in the Department of Neurosciences, working with children and young people with neurological disorders, brain tumours and brain trauma. I don't have lots of interest in facts and figures to show you. I'm just going to tell you about my role. These are just some of the things my general role includes. I prepare the child or young person about what is going to happen to them and discuss with them things that we can do to get them through the process and try to keep them relaxed. The age range on the ward varies from newborn babies up to 18 years of age. So I try to ensure I provide a range of play activities to suit all developmental ages and stages. I work closely with physio, occupational therapists and speech and language therapists to try to bring play into the rehabilitation programmes so that they don't actually realise they are working. With regards to the Edinburgh Cancer Centre, often the first course of treatment for a brain tumour is radiotherapy. This is provided within the Edinburgh Cancer Centre over at the Western General Hospital. I travel over to the centre with the family and introduce them to the staff over there, and then we all have a look around to see what all the different machines are. Normally, each child has 6 weeks of radiotherapy, which involves travelling to and from the centre 5 days a week for those 6 weeks of treatment. I'm normally only there for the first couple of sessions, and I have a fantastic relationship with the staff who work over there. Coping strategies are devised to get the child or young person through difficult procedures. We'll normally discuss beforehand what we can do to get through the procedure. It may be singing, shouting, chatting, sometimes swearing, looking at their iPad or tablet. It's whatever the child wants to do. And because I'm a non-clinical member of the team, I have the time to be able to put aside to offer any support required or to just allocate time to sit with the child or young person to just ask how they're feeling about things. So today I'm going to talk about, it's quite common that children who have had a tumour, they can go for several years without anything happening. So I'm going to speak about when it's no longer stable, it started changing. And as you can see, they've already been through surgery, rehab, radiotherapy sometimes, chemotherapy, and then they're starting to see the whole process again. It's very easy to assume that these children won't need as much information about the treatments, procedures, etc., since they've already been through it before. However, each course of treatment, as far as I'm concerned, should be treated as different and new, and therefore the child or young person given the opportunity to have everything explained to them again, rather than just assuming they will already know what's going to happen. Because they are older, they may have more knowledge of their illness than before. They may be old enough to use social media, Google, etc., to give them further, often inaccurate, information about their illness. They will also be more aware of body changes due to their treatment or illness, such as hair loss, weight gain. And this, in turn, can lead to them excluding themselves from their friends and causing low self-esteem, lack of confidence, etc. This can have a huge effect on their emotional well-being, and part of my role is to listen and allow them to speak freely and in confidence away from everyone else. They have to make decisions about the treatment, but also about things in their future. Some of these treatments mentioned can cause infertility. And several years ago, I worked with a 12-year-old boy. He wasn't fazed that his tumour had grown, but he started getting really upset when the doctor started talking to him and his parents about the possibility of freezing sperm for the future. This isn't a decision you should have to be making at the age of 12, but unfortunately, it is a conversation that needs to take place. As you can see in Article 12 from the United Nations Convention on the Rights of a Child, part of my role is to ensure that this right is exercised for every child and young person, and I'd hope that I'm doing some of this by doing the things I mentioned before. My role is slightly different with the families who have previously been through treatment. I'll sit down with the whole family and discuss what they've been told and what the plan is. I chat about how they're feeling and allow them to be honest about what they feel. I chat to them about the previous treatment and what they remember about it, and it's normally during this that any anxieties or problems come to light. I also chat privately to the child or young person if they want to. I also leave the option open to the child or young person that they can come to me later if they don't wish to now. I also ask how much involvement they would like me to have during the treatment. I can't assume every child's going to want to speak to me or even going to like me. It's up to them. I advise about different charities which may be able to help them with completing forms for any benefits they are entitled to, charities that can offer support, or charities that help to organise transport for hospital appointments, etc. And I can put them in touch with the charities, or I can ask the charities to come and speak to the family. If I'm concerned that a child or young person is not going to be able to tolerate a procedure, then I feel confident I can speak to my colleagues who would be involved, and we would see if we come up with a plan to help the child or young person get through it. Every child or young person may have different concentration levels, and what works with one may not work with another. Therefore, I chat about what's available for the preparation and distraction, and then we work out what would work best for them. For radiotherapy sessions, we know beforehand how long the radiotherapy is going to last for, and therefore we try and find some music or songs so that they know when it comes to, often it can be about 9 minutes long, so we'd listen to three songs and they know when they get to the last song, they're nearly finished their treatment. I've put down that as I act as an advocate for the child, as I often already know the families from their previous experience, and there's already a bond formed, and hopefully some trust. It may be that the child or young person confides in me that there are certain things that they didn't like in their previous treatment, and I can then see if there are different choices or methods available. A simple example of this is where a child or young person had a particularly traumatic experience prior to having a general anaesthetic. Often these children develop a fear or dislike of needles due to the amount of procedures they have had to get done previously. I could offer to speak to the anaesthetist to ask whether it would be possible for the child or young person to use a mask to go off to sleep and have the cannula inserted once they are asleep so that they don't feel anything. This may sound like a simple enough request, but it's not just about giving them choices, it's about empowering them and helping them to feel that they have some control over the treatment and also show them that someone is listening. My job isn't just about providing support and information to families. I'm also responsible for providing the fun elements. Up here are just some of the things that we do on the ward. A lot of our children can spend several months on the ward, and my role is trying to alleviate some of the boredom which comes during this period. For dancing, we have a dance teacher who comes in one day a week. That's funded by the Edinburgh Children's Hospital charity that we make referrals to. She comes to the ward, chats to the patient, finds out what kind of music they like, and then creates a plan for doing a 20-minute dance session. She easily adapts her dancing to suit the child's ability, so if they can only move their head, she'll do something with that. If they can only move their hands or fingers, their arms, she'll adapt it. My job has lots of fun elements, and all of the activities mentioned on this slide can be adapted to suit different developmental ages and stages. For children with visual or hearing impairments, I have a selection of items that vibrate or tickle. I'm also lucky enough to be able to take some patients outside, obviously with permission, I don't just go walking out with children, to let them experience what's going on around them. Like summer in the meadows, we go for picnics, we just go out and watch or listen to dogs barking and run around, we collect leaves, we experience rain, snow, hot and cold, just to bring some normality back to them. For older children, I can close off the playroom to give them an opportunity for their friends to visit so they can speak privately and as they normally would without feeling everyone is listening to them, as my ward is an open ward without any cubicles. Obviously, this would only be if the young person wanted their friends to visit, as often they don't because their appearance may have changed or things that they can do might have changed due to surgery or due to their treatment, so they don't always want their friends to visit. I do have permission, and I'm very friendly with my next photo. I don't know if anyone here will know him. This is Robbie. Robbie was a normal little boy until he was diagnosed with a brain tumour several years ago. The tumour has affected his language, his sight, and his mobility. This is us having some fun time in the playroom making a fingerprint tree. Robbie's a very affectionate boy, and although he can't see, he always recognises my voice, even if I haven't seen him for months. He loves cuddles, stroking hair, and I call him the magpie because if you have rings on your fingers, he'll get them off you without even realising that you've done it. This is what we made that day. It's our fingerprint tree. Article 31 applies in all areas of childcare, including healthcare, and I'm fortunate that my role is to help ensure this right is being met for all children and young people in hospital. I get lots of comments from many people saying that I must have a great job playing with children all day, which I suppose I do. Hope you've enjoyed this short talk, and I also hope that you can tell that I really enjoyed my job and I find it very rewarding. It's not working. There was I did a last slide. It was just about play being, I don't think I've got it on here, but it was a very fun about just adding lots of things just to make, including broccoli, to make play very fun. Okay, thank you.
Margaret, thank you very much. I'm desperate to see if we can get that last picture. I just want to see broccoli. No, not going to happen. Okay. I'd like. Are you two going to do this together or... Right, come on then, this is going to be fun. Ladies and gentlemen, can I introduce two MSYPs? Thank you very much. We are all yours.
Hello, everyone. Thanks to Children's Health Scotland for having us here to speak on behalf of the Scottish Youth Parliament. My name's Thomas McKechin, and I'm the MSYP for Glasgow Pollock, I'm the trustee for campaigns and projects at SYP as well.
I'm Chloe Robertson. I'm a MSYP for Cunningham South, and I'm the SYP's committee of convener for health and wellbeing.
So I just wanted to briefly start by explaining a little bit about SYP. So we're here to talk to you a little bit about our campaigns in order to provide a basis for the discussion on approaches and challenges in addressing children and young people's health and emotional wellbeing. We're going to talk about SYP. So briefly, we have two MSYPs elected every 2 years in a Scottish Parliament constituency, and we have around 160 MSYPs present, aged between 14 and 25, but they represent the views of young people aged 12 to 25. Every one of SYP's 32 local authorities support SYP at present, and something we're both very grateful for and proud of, because it allows us to genuinely represent the views of all of Scotland's young people. We are a fundamentally rights-based organisation, and our mission, vision and values are grounded in the United Nations Convention of the Rights of the Child. In particular, our purpose embodies Article 12. Young people have the right to express their views freely and have their opinions listened to in all matters that affect them. As a completely youth-led organisation, the words and sentiment of Article 12 have a profound importance on our work. Chloe is a member of the Conveners Group, a group of democratically elected 10 young people who lead SYP's policy and campaigns. Our democratically elected members listen to and recognise the issues that are most important to young people, ensuring their voices are heard by decision makers. And we exist to provide a national platform for young people to discuss the issues that are important to them and campaign to effect the change that they wish to see. And inclusion and diversity are really important to SYP, as well as political impartiality and rights, which we'll come on to a little bit later. So firstly, I want to explain a little bit about SYP's campaign from last year, which we chose to be about young people's mental health. And we see this as a big challenge to children and young people's health and wellbeing. Like all SYP's work, this campaign was developed by young people, and its key objectives were to increase young people's awareness and understanding of the issues associated with mental health, to encourage the use of common language in order to promote positive conversations and tackle stigma associated with young people's mental health, to identify young people's awareness and experience of mental health information and services for young people across Scotland, and to advocate for mental health services and information provision for all of Scotland's young people, with support and guidance on best practice for service providers. We wanted to hear from young people themselves and use their voices and experiences to advocate for high quality mental health information, support and services. So that's really how our research came about. MSYPs spent the first part of last year gathering responses from almost 1,500 young people aged 12 to 26 on the awareness and experience of mental health information, support and services, making this piece of research one of the largest of its kind in Scotland. And SYP staff also conducted focus groups with 30 young people. These key findings formed the basis of our report, Our Generation's Epidemic, and this title actually came out of one of the focus groups. One of the young people had mentioned in their response that it was our generation's epidemic, so we thought it was best to title or report that, because it basically gets the message across. So from the report, we found out a number of things, and there's a lot of it, so I'm not going to cover all of it today, but I've picked out some of the key points. To quickly highlight some of these, the research shows that there is a worrying lack of awareness amongst young people about available information, support and services. Worryingly, 74% of young people who took part in the research did not know what mental health information, support and services are available in their local area. And even more worryingly, of those who considered themselves to have experienced a mental health problem, 70% did not know what was locally available. SYP's research also found that 1 in 5 respondents do not know where to go for advice and support for a mental health problem. Young people also identified that in addition to embarrassment and fear of being judged, a lack of understanding about mental health is a major barrier to talking openly about mental health. In terms of experience of mental health information support and services, young people aged between 18 and 26-year-olds, 18 to 26 are less likely to find information about mental health young person friendly than those aged between 12 and 17. And young people also told us that they felt that public information about mental health should be tailored according to different age groups. When it came to support, 27% of young people do not feel supported to talk about mental health in their place of learning or workplace. And we got a lot of comments from young people about the lack of mental health education and support in schools, with a real feeling that mental health isn't a priority. And many of the young people we spoke to had experience with mental health. They identified a range of challenges that they faced, including a lack of accessibility and confidentiality, not being taken seriously due to their age, and a lack of person-centred treatment. And services that are young person-specific were identified as positive examples of mental health services, with young people saying that they had positive experiences of services with staff trained in young people's issues and taking a young person-friendly approach, which I'm sure is something we'll come on to later on. So those were the main issues that were identified, but we also came up with some recommendations. So on the slide here, we've sort of pointed them out. And we've highlighted some of the issues that we felt you might be able to help us deliver, and these are in the report too. At a local level, we provided MSYPs with a campaign action plan that gave them a set of resources to campaign for improved service provision and support in their local area. And one MSYP actually took that a little bit further and developed their own campaign, their own sort of mental health action plan, which was launched fairly recently. Launched today, which it's amazing. I've had a look at it. It's a really great piece of work, and it just shows the impact that young people actually designing and co-designing these sorts of things with organisations can have. At a national level, we engaged with the Scottish Government ministers, including the Deputy First Minister and the Mental Health Minister, officials, MSPs, parties as well. And we also work quite closely with NHS, Education Scotland, and COSLA. So, given that, what did the campaign achieve? The campaign managed to ensure young people influenced the Scottish Government's mental health strategy, as well as securing agreement that CAM services should be extended to 18 to 25-year-olds. Culturally, also, we triggered many great conversations about mental health, mental without stigma, which has brought about other campaigns such as SAMH's Going to Be campaign, which we fully support. We're still continuing to work on mental health, taking part in discussions such as this today, carrying on the conversation at local and school levels, and continuing to influence the mental health strategy. We can also look at mental health and rights. Mental health and rights with our new campaign, which I'll hand over to Chloe now to talk to you a little bit about.
I'm now excited to introduce to you all SYP's new national campaign on young people's rights, which launched just over a week ago, entitled Right Here, Right Now. This campaign will run until October 2018. Campaigners are selected by MSYPs, and this year was Young People's Rights. And it was selected at a sitting in June after we consulted with 5,000 young people across Scotland. We are currently working with a range of partner organisations, some of whom are here today and who have helped to steer the direction of our campaign. One of the key things our national campaign is about is not solely focusing on the UN Convention of the Rights of the Child. In most cases, the UNCRC covers young people up to the age of 18. And as SYP represents young people up to the age of 25, this campaign will look wider than just the UNCRC to ensure that this older age group is recognised and to give MSYPs representing national voluntary organisations a greater role in campaigning activities than has been possible in previous SYP campaigns. The key campaign messages of Right Here, Right Now have both a local and national focus, concentrating on strengthening the protection of young people's rights in Scotland, reinforcing the links between MSYPs and local decision makers, and between SYP and national institutions, and empowering young people to defend their own rights and the rights of others. By the end of this campaign, SYP wants Scotland's young people to be aware of and understand their own rights and be empowered to take action to defend their own rights and those of others. And we also want Scotland's decision makers to make a human rights-based approach to all policy making, service provision and planning, ensuring that young people's voices are at the heart of decisions that are affecting them. The objectives of this campaign are closely related to the campaign themes, which I'll talk about shortly, and the key messages. As such, the objectives of Right Here, Right Now are to influence law, policy and practice in order to strengthen the protection of young people's rights and to improve links between SYP, public bodies and national institutions, such as the Scottish Parliament, to respect, protect and promote young people's rights. To promote young people's rights and empower individuals to defend their own rights and those of others, and also to strengthen and enhance the status of MSYPs as the voice of Scotland's young people at a local level, and to strengthen the role of voluntary organisation MSYPs nationally. Each objective has a set of outputs and outcomes which are outlined in the campaign strategy, and all of the campaign plans are designed with a goal of achieving these. Given the complex and wide-ranging scope of young people's rights, there are many areas this campaign could focus on. Following conversations with the conveners group and partner organisations, it was agreed that this campaign will focus on three main themes. Our first theme is advocacy, which is the overarching campaign theme, aiming to influence law, policy and practice in order to strengthen the protection of young people's rights. There's so many activities we're doing for this, so I'll just a few of them is we're calling for the incorporation of the UNCRC into Scots law, and also calling on the Scottish Government to produce a child and young people's rights national action plan, and ensuring young people's views are at the heart of the Scottish Government's 2018 report on the current state of children and young people's rights. Another campaign theme is action, which is focusing on the Article 12 of the UNCRC. This theme will seek to strengthen and enhance the status of MSYPs at a local level and within national voluntary organisations, and to improve the links SYP has with other institutions such as the Scottish Parliament. SYP and individual MSYPs embody Article 12 of the UNCRC, the right for young people's views to be heard. The main activities in this theme will focus on building links with local decision makers by encouraging them to sign a pledge and commit to working more closely with MSYPs in their areas, and also Rights Week, which SYP will be running in December. Another campaign theme is awareness, which is promoting young people's rights to young people and those responsible for upholding these rights. It's essential that this campaign prioritises empowering young people to take action to realise, promote and defend their own rights and those of others. This campaign comes at what we feel is a key and watershed moment for children and young people's rights in Scotland. We've seen the commitment to exploring incorporation in the programme for the government, as well as support for legal protection, which we've been campaigning for. There's still so much work to be done, of course, but in the area of mental health and rights, as well as the rights for 16 and 17 year olds to vote in UK elections and combating mosquito devices, to name a few areas in which we're actively promoting young people's rights. If anything comes out of this campaign, the empowerment of children and young people to be human rights defenders and encouraging others to do so is something we're really hoping to achieve. We're delighted to be here today to learn more about the work of Children's Health Scotland. We recognise and applaud all the work you do to promote child healthcare rights to children, young people, their families and practitioners, and we want to support and amplify the work you already do. We are delighted to join you in advocating a human rights-based approach to healthcare provision for sick children and young people based on participation, accountability, non-discrimination, empowerment and legality. If you would like to support us in our campaigning efforts, please come and speak to us today or get in touch with us on our website.
So that's kind of our little presentation over, but I just probably just should explain why we connected both our previous campaign and this campaign together. The reason we did that was because, as Chloe mentioned, we want to ensure that there is a human rights-based approach to children and young people's health. You need to think about how we do that, and coming to an event like this is one way that that we would like to influence that discussion. So thank you for listening, and we look forward to answering your questions in a couple of minutes.
Chloe, Thomas, thank you ever so much for that. So there's a clear theme that's emerged this afternoon, with the focus being mental health and well-being. And the key themes have been identifying it and also managing it. And with the exception of Margaret, it's very much been in the community and in schools. So can I just perhaps tweak my master plan? We've in the next 20 minutes, I think it'd be really helpful to get some discussion going here. We'll then break for coffee. Can you put down on those pieces of paper, those post-its, one person from each table in the neatest handwriting, just one example, two if you're feeling generous, from of an initiative which has helped level the playing field, and in the context of what we were talking about this morning or this afternoon. So, coming back to this panel here, there's about 20,000 questions I've got in my mind. The whole focus is about mental health and well-being. Any openers for 10? Yes, please.
Rob Murray, Changing Faces. Thank you very much for those presentations. Given everything that's been said in the presentations and the increasing debate about CAM services, I'm intrigued to hear the views of Helen in particular, but the rest of the panel as well, about the pilot project that's happening in Wales, where children and young people can access CAM services within the school. Is that something we should adopt here in Scotland? What's your views?
I think... Personally, I think schools are an absolutely crucial place for identifying and also potentially doing a lot more than identifying children's mental health problems. I mean, in our clinical research, we've always, especially if it's school-based, we've always liaised very closely with educational psychology. And I think if it were possible to do that, it has been done in Scotland. In particular, you know, there have been pilot projects in Scotland. And I just think we need to be sitting down and getting our heads together on this, because it just makes a lot of sense to me. Mm. Interested in what my education colleagues think about that.
Just to add to that, certainly, again, I can only speak for City of Edinburgh, but we've had a huge increase in requests for support for young people who have basically school refusers, but it's an anxiety. We call them emotionally-based school refusers. And... schools are really, really struggling with, I think you might be able to reinforce that, schools are really struggling with the numbers of young people who aren't coming to school, but they don't really know why, they can't really pinpoint why, and because of that, there's no doctor that will say to our service, well, you should be going in to teach them because they have a health condition that's precluding them from going to school. So it's a bit of a catch-22, so they end up sitting at home getting nothing, with no provision whatsoever. So I think if there was something in school to try and capture these learners before they went down the road of not attending. I think that would be a really helpful resource.
And I would absolutely agree with that as well. I think the kind of the key point is about this collaboration, and it's about the early intervention and prevention and trying to stop problems before they actually arise. Now, we all know that CAMHS is the tip of the iceberg. They can only possibly see the small percentage. And in a culture where children don't have the resilience to deal with situations themselves as well as they possibly could have, teachers are left dealing with a lot more kind of anxiety, depression, poor well-being, you know, moving on to things like even like insomnia. You know, we can't get kids through the door in the morning on time because they go to their beds and their minds are racing. Mm-hmm. And I think what I've always been pushing for was about that tier one level. It's about the discussions with CAMHS, the putting together of heads and looking about how can we ease the pressure, you know, within the CAMHS service, but ultimately supports what schools are there to do as well, as to educate, not just academically, but socially and emotionally. To bring that bit of parity to it and really support these pupils at the earliest possible interventions. But I think it's like everything. It's, you know, there are financial constraints, there's staffing implications, there's time, I think, would be the one implication that goes across everything that we've discussed today. But absolutely, and I think as we spoke earlier on, with regards to the social work, we are, as educationalists, more than happy to speak with anybody. In fact, my current school, what we're trying to do is trying to get more agencies involved within school so that we can actually have these conversations, these discussions, so that we can, you know, be creative and creating bespoke, you know, provision for the pupils.
Mm-hmm. Una.
Thank you very much. Una McFadden, I'm a paediatrician, and I really want to try and link to the young people and Helen the question. And it's about thinking about when we had GIRFEC in action, we were talking about communicating about the child. But one of the issues that I find in paediatrics is that sometimes my concern is about the parent's mental health, and we have no pathway to refer a parent other than to try and persuade their GP that they might need help. And that's actually a huge challenge to that parent, even if they accept our suggestion. So I'm wondering, for the young people, do you think that the children should have a right to have their parents' health, including mental health, assessed for the good of the child? And then linking back to Helen is to say, I have certainly seen some young parents where I suspect that they have mild fetal alcohol syndrome and short-term memory problems, which seems to fit with that picture of forgetting that you were meant to see somebody. And like you, I find that it's never intentional, but it can be 6, 7, 8 non-attendances, and by then our authorities say they shouldn't be being asked back. So again, to the young people, young people have a right to have the appointments that they are being offered implemented by an authority taking over. Thank you.
Okay, so Thomas and Chloe, first of all, parents, what do you do with them?
You've stumped me. Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, the UNCRC is... thank you. It's all about making sure that young people have their rights protected and have the best start in life. And if the parent is the issue there that's maybe stopping that, then perhaps I don't know how you'd implement that. I think which maybe is the problem, but absolutely, I think we need to be taking a rights-based approach to these sorts of things, and thinking about, you know, this child and children and young people have the right to have these rights. You know, is there a way that we can ensure that these children have these rights, I've actually forgotten what I'm trying to say, but yeah, absolutely, 100%. I think we need to take a more rights-based approach that way. Yeah.
It does open a can of worms about responsibility. Helen, do you have any concepts on?
I just think it's really interesting to hear you say that, and I think that would be a very radical change to the way we do things. But maybe we do need some quite radical changes. I was chatting with a good friend and colleague, Suzanne McRae, who's worked for many, many years with Looked After Accommodated Children, and she was thinking, surely there must be a way of engaging the named person for young people in those circumstances. And I'm not suggesting that the named person should be kind of hovering over every child at all. But what about those very few children who do have problems that would be treatable and who are not accessing services because their parents are unable to access them for whatever reason? I don't know how that... This is such delicate ground. But I really do think we need to be starting to have these conversations, because it isn't fair that a few children who really could benefit from treatments are being denied them.
I just remembered what I was going to say. So my mum has a series of mental health issues, and had someone stepped in and helped my mum, I would never have, I don't know this for a fact, but I have a feeling that I don't think I would have developed the mental health issues that I have. So had someone stepped in, you know, helped my mum, then I would have been able to get help as well, because my mum would have understood the issue a little bit more. So yes, 100%.
And just to echo that, thanks so much for sharing that, because I think it's working with families who've had their children taken into care, for example, I've just been struck that all of those families are really trying to do the best by their kids. So it's how do we support parents to access services for their children without it being pejorative, because they will want it as much as anybody else. It's just sometimes really hard to get your act together with it, I think, if you've got struggles.
Oh. Okay, right, thanks. So it's Russell, and I think Anne's got a point.
Yeah, just very quickly, just very much touching on the point what you referred to about the named person. You know, I am a named person for approximately 200 pupils, and as I alluded to in my speech, it's dependent on the school that you work in. It can be quite difficult to see these pupils, you know, in the wider sense as often as you possibly would like. With regards to kind of support for parents, most definitely, you know, what certain things that we've done within schools before have been to address any initiative that we're running out and trying to invite parents in to get their understanding of that, whether that just be a study support scheme. You know, I mean, absolutely agree, if there's mental health issues at home, if there's mental health issues with staff with stress, how can we expect our youngsters to develop good, positive strategies and coping strategies. As you move through, and a lot of, as you can imagine, quite sensitive situations that you do come across sometimes as named person, is about the ability to support the parent as well. Now, I'm not advocating and putting responsibility on myself, saying, yes, I think there comes a stage, but there are times, there are rights of the child that, you know, they can instruct their own solicitor at a time. If that kid wants to, you know, get, you know, receive a service, then they are entitled to receive that service. But it's also about supporting the child with their understanding of their rights, but also sometimes to have that really difficult conversation with the parents. And that those conversations, for those of you that have done them, are very challenging. You know, they can be very troublesome. But it's my job and one of my kind of responsibilities as a named person to have these challenges, to have these conversations, to try and be persuasive, to also to try and put support in place for the adults. You know, parent to parent is one organisation that works very well. It's a kind of advocacy-based service in that as well. You know, to support the parents and their understanding about, well, this could help, and this could support you, and this could support your child as well. But very, very sensitive, and the named person role collectively, you know, in the press at the moment would there's a lot of stuff to be said. You know what I mean, about what we should be doing and what we shouldn't be doing. And to be honest with you, I don't think we should just be giving lip service to it. I think we should be given the tools to actually make a bigger difference, and I really do. Although it might give me more grey hair, that's okay with me. But I really do think it's something that it needs to be addressed.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks.
Just very quickly, I think the DNA thing that comes from hospitals should be changed to child not taken, because I think the language is really important. Children don't DNA their own appointments. It's parents don't take them, so you're quite right. And I think that's particularly the kind of families we would target in our project. So if we see a couple of DNAs for children, we contact the families and say, is there still an issue? Why didn't you go? And we've not had any sort of hostile reactions to that. And sometimes it's just the chaos of hospital appointments. Actually, we forget that people get their appointments 3 months away from when they're actually been there, and then they don't remember. So there are ways and ways around it. And for school-informed trauma, if you go onto YouTube and Google Walla Walla School, that's a school in Washington that the ACE team from Wales went over to see how they had changed their entire way they approached adverse experience in childhood. It's extremely interesting because the whole school is now a trauma-informed school, and that's bled out into the community, where 60% of the community is actually trauma-informed as well. So they really upped their game, and that was a school where children went to that were deemed as failing children. They weren't educatable, so they had to go to this school. And now they're the school in the area that most parents want to refer to because their standards are so good now. Walla Walla. Walla Walla. Yeah.
I mean, there's a whole can of worms that this whole situation raises, in that if we're expecting colleagues in the community from an educational background to work out whether parents and or children need help from the mental health department, it's not quite so easy. I've got a very practical and simple question in my mind in terms of what we call stuff. We're clear that we've got 10% of young people have a mental illness, and then this concept of mental well-being. Is there a terminology for the grey bit between the two? And I think we've touched on it on anxiety. Russell had a very nice slide that had anxiety, school refusal, sexuality, all of that. Is anyone aware of a term for that hinterland? Because I think it would be really neat to actually call what we all recognise as a problem summit. Because calling it mental unwell-being is wrong.
Effectively, you can categorise it in a number of ways, but you could probably categorise it as barriers to learning. Barriers to learning. You know what I mean? Despite the fact it's emotional and emotional well-being, and it's all the things that were on that slide were barriers to learning. You know, they are barriers
to learning. Right. This is my, again, another insight into the vast amount of my ignorance. If anybody's aware of a term, please come and let me know. If there isn't a term, it'd be quite a nice thing to have at the end of this day. What do we call this thing that we know is a problem that is unmet, but we can't really measure, but I suspect falls an awful lot on guidance teachers? And the downstream implications are probably quite significant.
Vulnerable children, that's our starting point. And that vulnerable, yeah. I know it's not just about mental, but that's just this, you need a starting point.
Yeah.
And from a generalist point of view, that makes sense, because we're not specialists, we're not trying to categorise people. Because as you know, things do overlap, physical and mental health overlap, and various issues.
Just wondering whether the label vulnerability might...
It is difficult to get the...
I need to be asking these two at the end. What do you think about it? Come up with a name. Perhaps over coffee.
I've always just referred to it as mental health. I've never really known another term, really. I can't think of anything else.
No.
No. Right. Okay. Listen, it's 3 o'clock in the...
I think mental health, everybody has mental health. It's not just people who have mental health problems that have mental health. So I think we kind of need to change the conversation from a kind of negative one, or maybe like a non-empowering one, talking about kind of victims of mental health or people who are vulnerable, although we do need to address people with specific vulnerabilities, and talk about it as, you know, how can we have positive conversations about mental health and look at the term not as a negative thing maybe, but just as a thing that exists and we all have it, and it's good to kind of make sure that it's doing well.
I fully accept. I just think there's a hinterland that we haven't got a good label for. Anyway, if I can perhaps, first of all, on behalf of you, thank the panel for their thoughts, their insight. I've really enjoyed that session. That was really good. Oh, this is the broccoli. Love, sunshine, and broccoli. Now, my daughters have a problem with broccoli. They don't mind love or sunshine. But no, I like that, Margaret. I think that's cracking. So, your task over the next 20 minutes, ladies and gentlemen, is to go and have some coffee, but also to get these pink post-its out. Now, there are 10 tables. So we know that there should be at least 10 pink and 10 green post-its out there. And if you could just think of a local initiative that's helped to level the playing field, both in the context of mental health that we're talking about this afternoon, and about perhaps what we call vulnerable children, as we were talking in the second half of the morning. You have been tasked with your responsibility. I should be looking for all good people already filling it in. Go and get your coffee, come back. We're back, meeting back here at 3:20. Thank you very much.